Support for The World's Podcast comes from LegalZoom. With over 17 years and more than 2 million customers, LegalZoom provides helpful support, legal advice, and transparency for business owners. More information at LegalZoom.com/world.
Go ahead, sleep in, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The EU fulfills the dreams of students and office workers everywhere. It's getting rid of daylight saving time.
Those who want to stay on summertime move in the spring of 2021, and those who want to stay on permanent wintertime change their clocks for the last time in the fall, I think. Or is it the other way around?
Also, Uganda shows it's eager for China's investment.
They believe learning Chinese gives Ugandans a competitive edge on the global stage.
And Ukraine's presidential election has an epic field of candidates.
Well, we've got a massive ballot paper, actually. There are 39 candidates. They were holding it up. It's a big piece of paper.
How a comedian in Ukraine is upending the campaigns of two old-school politicians. Those stories today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Great you could be here this Wednesday. We begin today with the Russian threat. For an American these days, that phrase might conjure up concerns over election interference and online trolls. Someone in the Republic of Georgia, though, might have bigger worries, like, what if Russia invades with soldiers, not cyberbots? In fact, Russia did invade Georgia in 2008 under the pretext of protecting Russian minorities there, and Russian troops still occupy parts of the country. Such is life in a former Soviet republic still under Russia's huge shadow. And right now, Russia is not happy that Georgia has been hosting a NATO military exercise for the past week or so. NATO, of course, being a U.S.-led military alliance. Lieutenant General Ben Hodges was commander of the U.S. Army in Europe until his retirement in 2017. We caught up with him in Vilnius, the capital of Lithuania, another former Soviet republic. So, Lieutenant General, these military exercises in Georgia, it's kind of like NATO is poking the Russian bear. Why is that?
Well, of course, Marco, number one, we're not poking the Russian bear. We are working with a country that's been with us in Afghanistan, that's been a partner for years, and that is on the path to membership in the alliance, but yet has 20% of its country occupied by Russian forces.
You're referring to Georgia there.
10 years after the Russians said that they would leave. So this is not, I would disagree with your characterization that we are somehow poking the Russian bear.
More than 10 years ago, NATO agreed that Georgia would eventually join the pact. Why has that not happened?
I think there's probably a couple of reasons. For me personally, Georgia should be a member of the alliance right now. They've got nothing left to prove. But there are some, I believe, there are some member nations that are reluctant because they do see that Russian troops still occupy 20% of Georgia. So, in effect, those nations are giving Russia a veto over membership in the alliance, and I don't think that's right. I believe that Russia respects strength, and if the alliance is strong and Georgia is welcomed into the alliance, then I don't believe that Russia will act on that because the last thing they want is a conflict with NATO.
Lieutenant General Hodges, what have you heard from Georgians about their hopes and fears for the future? Do they see NATO membership as one of their few options for defense against Russia?
I think that the Georgians are rightfully frustrated that after years of being told that they were going to be welcomed into the alliance, that it still hasn't happened yet, of course, which is exactly what the Russians want. So there is some frustration, but most of the responsible leaders in Georgia, military, political, academics that I've spoken with, are confident that this is eventually going to happen. I'm confident that it's eventually going to happen. It's just I wish it was happening sooner rather than later.
As you know, there are a lot of people who look at NATO and say relations have been undermined and weakened by President Trump. How do you see it?
Well, I have to say that I'm disappointed that the way that my president has treated allies is not helpful. I mean, should nations be doing more, especially Germany, for example, and some of the other wealthier Western European countries? Absolutely, they should. Every president has done that. But I think there's a better approach to doing this. And I think the constant, I mean, when the president refers to the EU as an enemy of the United States, I mean, that's a gift to the president of the Russian Federation and also to the president of China. Mm. So this is not helpful. Now, to be fair, the president since he became president, everything that President Obama promised to the alliance, rotational forces, prepositioned equipment, increased spending, it's all happened. Everything that's been delivered that President Obama promised has been delivered under the Trump administration. So I think it's important to keep that in mind. It's so unhelpful when he's kicking our most important allies in the ass publicly and doing things that are not helpful. I never in my life imagined an American president would call into question Article 5. That's unbelievable to me, and it's causing people to have to do a lot of extra work to explain, don't worry, we're still committed, you know, we're here.
Well, speaking of Article 5, that's the part of NATO that states that an attack on one member, it's an attack on all members. You support Georgia being part of NATO. Do you think Americans are ready to die for Georgia if Russian tanks roll in once more?
Well, of course, you know, we have American soldiers that are there almost nonstop. You've had Georgians die alongside Americans in Afghanistan. So when you think about what Georgia does and how the United States traditionally loves small countries like this that have a fighting spirit and that are willing to do what it takes for their own independence, I think you would find very strong support in the United States, particularly in the Congress, for this. So, I would not see that as a problem at all. Now, at the end of the day, it does come down to civilian leadership explaining to the population, just like in every other country, you know, why it is we're doing what we're doing and why it's to the overall benefit of all of us to have collective security.
Lieutenant General Ben Hodges, former commander of the U.S. Army in Europe. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, guys, thanks for the opportunity.
In Syria last week, Kurdish-led forces took over the last piece of territory occupied by the so-called Islamic State. But amid the celebrations, Kurdish authorities say they're struggling to cope with the thousands of ISIS men and women they've captured. Right now, they're being held in camps, but eventually, the Kurds want an international court to put the fighters on trial. My BBC colleague Ali McBool was given rare access to one of the detention camps in northern Syria.
Well, now that that final enclave has been recaptured from the Islamic State group in Baghouz, one of the many unanswered questions is what happens now, not just to the IS fighters who surrendered or who were captured, but the wives and children of those fighters as well. Of course, many women themselves came out to join the IS group of their own volition, and 450 of them are here in this camp in Al-Raj in northeastern Syria with their families. And the ones here are from more than 40 different nationalities.
For my children, normally, because they don't know what the house is, they only know what is a tent.
They include Ilham from the Netherlands, who admits to having joined IS, but as yet has no idea where she might face trial.
They are asking the government to take us back, but I'm still here, I'm waiting.
If you did go back to Holland, what do you think would happen?
I go to prison. My children, I hope, to my family. That's what's going to happen.
And you could accept that?
Yeah. Because I know I make a mistake.
Well, you'll understand there are people around the world and they will think, well, leave her there. If she wanted to go leave her
there. Yeah, but it's no matter what people think about me.
But it does matter what people think. Public opinion in home countries means that few Western nations are taking back their IS group citizens. So dealing with them has been left to the ill-equipped Kurdish administration. Unfortunately, the international community has disappointed us, says the Kurdish head of foreign relations, Abdul Karim Omar. We can't hold and try these people alone. If the world doesn't help us, there'll be a problem again, and the Islamic State group will once again be a danger for all of us. After the final offensive to wipe the so-called Islamic State from the map, we saw trucks that carted away hundreds of IS families. An ignominious end for the militants, but we heard the sounds of children coming from the trucks. Children, thousands of whom are foreign, who are now in the detention camps with their IS group mothers. If we don't rehabilitate those children and don't return them to their home country, says Abdul Karim Omar, we're just ensuring they'll remain immersed in this dangerous ideology and will be the prospective terrorists of the future. Back at Al-Raj camp, children are everywhere, and there is no plan in place to repatriate them. The people in this region have suffered living under IS, have given huge sacrifices fighting IS, and are now burdened with holding IS members indefinitely. The warning is that in an unstable region, anything could happen to those detainees. The fear of the Kurds here is that now the territory's been taken back from the Islamic State group and the military battle's been won, the world will show less concern about resolving all the issues left behind.
Our colleague Ali Makbul reporting for the BBC from northern Syria. Let's take a moment now. Here we go, ticking away the moments that make up a dull day. This next story is about time. The European Union, in its wisdom, is abolishing daylight saving time.
Hallelujah. Hallelujah.
Okay, I'd never editorialize, but I think it's okay to say I'm not a fan of daylight saving time. Too many missed trains, darkness at 4 p.m.
8:58. First time I've ever been early for work. Except for all those daylight savings days, lousy farmers.
Our clocks have already changed this spring, of course, and the Europeans are still planning to spring forward this coming weekend. But the last time they will do so will be in 2021. And here's someone, or something, to show us the way. The world's history guy, Chris Wolf, is here to give us a brief history of time. In this case, what happens in Europe in 2021, Chris?
So they have decided to abolish daylight saving time. What happens next is the individual nations of Europe have to decide whether they want to be on permanent summertime or permanent wintertime. Seems like an easy pick for me.
Yeah, I'd say so. But, I mean, if a lot of countries are splitting their decisions winter, summer, that could also be really confusing. It's actually going to happen because so many non-binding things are proposed by Brussels.
Yes, absolutely. It's passed and it's now in the implementation phase. So the schedule is for those who want to stay on summertime move in the spring of 2021, and those who want to stay on permanent wintertime change their clocks for the last time in the fall, I think. Or is it the other way around?
You're already confused. Regardless, is this a popular move over there?
Yeah, they did a survey as part of the process about deciding whether to do this, and it got an astonishing 84% approval from the people who responded. So yes, out of several million who did so. So it seems like it's going to be hugely popular, as I'm sure it would be here.
So why is Europe now getting rid of it, or at least deciding to get rid of it?
So the supposed benefits of saving energy don't really happen anymore. Modern light bulbs are so much more efficient, plus people are wasting electricity in so many other more creative ways that being indoors or outdoors isn't going to make much difference. And then there are huge benefits to be had. Business has been pushing this in particular because they just like to schedule meetings. Like, it doesn't help if you imagine you're setting up a meeting in New York, New Zealand, and Paris. If you're doing it in April or the fall, Sydney's going to go backwards because of it's down under on the southern hemisphere. We're going to go forward. And then suddenly you've got like five or six different time changes in the space of a couple of weeks. Doesn't happen at the same time. So that simple business cost is huge. Plus, there's a noted social cost, suicide spike after daylight saving time. There's always problems with tardiness, travel, absenteeism. These are all, you know, real business costs. So that's kind of what's driving this.
Can this happen here?
Well, Marco, you're asking the federal government and the Congress to actually decide something. So I can guess you can put that into the realm of possibility, but not probability. States do and can request exemptions. All of Arizona is supposedly exempt, although the Navajo Nation within Arizona has an exemption from the exemption. So it gets kind of confusing even there.
Well, as not a big fan of DST, I'll keep my fingers crossed and not hold my breath. The world's Chris Wolf, thank you for your time.
You're welcome, Marco.
And before we take a short break, we want to tell you about another thing lawmakers in Brussels made moves on this week, a controversial directive that opponents say could change the internet as we know it. Article 13, as it's called, requires big platforms like YouTube and Facebook to proactively filter out copyrighted material before it's posted on their sites. This Swedish gamer who makes a living live streaming on sites like Twitch says it sounds good in principle.
But the issue with this is that it's going to be very restricting.
More on Article 13 coming up on the show later this week. If you want to get an idea of how China uses soft power to expand its influence in Africa, check out the schools in Uganda. Right now, the Chinese government is funding Mandarin language lessons for students at 30 schools throughout Uganda, and there are similar programs in many other African countries. From Kampala, Uganda, my BBC colleague Catherine Biaruhanga has this report.
How do we say hello in Chinese?
Ni hao.
How do we respond?
Ni hao.
At Lubiri Secondary School in Kampala, the boys and girls aged between 12 and 14 years old have settled down for their second Mandarin lesson this term. It's a class of nearly 90 students, and they're all crammed together on benches. The Chinese government is funding this program by training 100 Ugandan teachers over 3 years to teach Mandarin and providing textbooks. However, it would not give an official figure on how much money is being spent on the educational project.
I'm really amazing. You see that
here for a visit is Mrs. Wang Li Hong Suma. Her college is training the Ugandan teachers and supervising them. She moved to Uganda over 20 years ago after falling in love with a Ugandan man.
This one is our firstborn.
Mrs. Wang tells me about the family photographs hanging on the walls of their apartment in Kampala. Her and her husband now have 3 children. Mrs. Wang has become a champion for these Mandarin classes. She believes they can only benefit Ugandans.
Chinese children, since they are young, they study what? English. We learn the language, we learn their technology, we learn their skills. And then we developed.
But some are suspicious of China's motives. There's been a growth in Africa in the number of Confucius Institutes named after China's most famous philosopher, teaching Mandarin and about Chinese culture. The first opened in Nairobi in 2005, and now there are nearly 60 centres across the continent. Fred Muhumza, a Ugandan economist, says the fact that the program here is Chinese government funded could raise concerns.
And then the questions would be, has it been forced on the Ugandan government? And the Ugandan government is forcing it down on its citizens. Is this Chinese imperialism taking over Africa's resources, taking even over Africa's cultures and languages?
We reached out to the Department of Education. They responded stating that it's not unusual for foreign governments to support the teaching of a language and that Ugandan officials were behind the development and formation of the entire Mandarin curriculum. They believe learning Chinese gives Ugandans a competitive edge on the global stage. By the end of 2021, Uganda's education department plans to have 50 schools teaching Mandarin. Like many countries in the region, Uganda suffers an unequal trade relationship with China. Supporters of Mandarin teaching hope it may help address the imbalance.
The BBC's Catherine Biaruhanga in Kampala, Uganda. It's not just Mandarin classes. China spreads its influence in Africa in lots of other ways, too. Aid and investment, trade and infrastructure loans, but also things like political boot camps, where some of Africa's next generation of leaders are flown to China to train with the Communist Party. Lina Ben Abdallah is a professor at Wake Forest University.
These trainings typically are just a few days long, sometimes a few weeks long, with delegations from different African countries attending seminars, lectures, but also doing a guided tour of several cities in China to sort of showcase China's development. This is one type of investments in human capital. Other types are student scholarships, for example. In September 2018, during the 7th edition of the China-Africa Forum, President Xi Jinping had announced 50,000 of these scholarships to be given to African students in the next 3 years.
What does China want out of all of this?
Different things. China definitely is interested in a huge market, which the African continent provides. Of course, we know natural resources and minerals especially. We know that China, for example, brings about 90% of its cobalt reserves from DRC, which is in an African country. I mean, the other thing is Africa is, in a way, a low-stakes place for China's experiments in foreign policy, which is to say that it is a place where Chinese foreign policy can try things for the first time and see how they play out.
Is that a good thing for Africa? I mean, to be this laboratory for China?
I mean, it depends on which countries we're talking about. It depends on what governments and how a lot of African governments, especially we've seen lately in the Horn of Africa, have been doing a good job at playing and pitting the competition and getting better deals for their own countries. But at the same time, you know, it's also just a place where a lot of foreign powers have just not held any interest in the past 10, 15 years. And this had created a vacuum that made it possible for Chinese foreign policy to expand in ways that are not possible in other areas in the world. And in many ways, China's interest in the region as a player upped the competition a little bit. We see now, you know, French president going on tour in Africa. We see Japan trying to do the same thing, Russia trying to do the same thing. And in many ways, it is because China is looming in the background. So it actually does create a sort of a win-win for the African side because there is more competition now and there's more than one game in town.
In the report we just heard from Uganda, one critic was saying that this is just another example of imperialism. China wants to exploit our resources. Do you see Chinese involvement as a kind of new chapter in this long history of colonialism on the continent?
In my sense, I mean, it is definitely interesting and good to be critical and also think about what is it that African countries are winning from relationships to China. In the report that you mentioned about Mandarin Chinese being offered to teachers in Uganda so that they can teach it in secondary school, it just is one of these examples that I mentioned earlier in these investments in people-to-people relations. It's a way to bring Chinese language and culture because you don't just teach the language. It's about the history, it's the culture, it's a way of thinking. And that's bringing it to the regular African student, Ugandan student in a secondary school in rural areas, not necessarily only in the big city. And that will have long-term effects.
Isn't that kind of a form of soft power colonialism, though?
I mean, it is definitely soft power. It is also very smart. It's an investment in human capital is what it is, right? But at the same time, it certainly is a form of soft power. You can perhaps even call it imperialism at some degree. And I agree with sort of problematizing this and being critical about it.
And Lena, before you go, I just want to make sure that we're not overblowing the Chinese influence in Africa story here. Is China's growing influence specific to Africa, most visible in Africa, or is it just China's a major superpower everywhere?
Yes, I think China's growing influence is seen in sort of through these zoomed in lenses in Africa because it's just so comprehensive, from security to aid to human capital to scholarships, everything is there. To UN peacekeeping operations. But at the same time, that's not the only place where China is becoming a big power. We know through the Belt and Road, we're talking about Eurasia. Also, China's presence in Latin America is something that's kind of growing in terms of influence. So Africa, in a sense, is not unique in this case, but it's distinct because it's so comprehensive.
Lena Ben Abdallah, professor at Wake Forest University, thanks very much for explaining this all.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman. It is hard to get your head around the huge amount of military weapons countries buy on a regular basis.
This is the 2017 military budget of Kuwait.
Wow. We turn all that weapons data into sound just ahead here on The World. Saudi Arabia controls the skies over its southern neighbor, Yemen. Since the Saudis launched an air war against Yemeni rebels 4 years ago, nothing has flown in or out of Yemen without Saudi permission. So yesterday, when an airstrike hit within 50 yards of a hospital in northern Yemen, observers blamed Saudi Arabia, which gets most of its weapons from the United States.
Earlier this month, we learned just how many weapons the U.S. has been delivering to Saudi Arabia.
That's The World's Stephen Snyder, who's been tracking sales of American weapons used in the Middle East.
One of my go-to places for information about weapons is in Sweden, of all places, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. It's better known as SIPRI, and I've been speaking with Peter Vesemann. He's SIPRI's Middle East specialist.
And there's been a very significant growth in arms supplies to Saudi Arabia by the U.S.
How significant, Stephen?
A really big spike recently. We thought it would be interesting to show it in a way that you can only do on radio.
So this ticking sound, what does it represent?
Each tick-tock represents one calendar year. So we're hearing the amount of American weapons delivered to Saudi Arabia in each year since 2001.
What's his first note?
Well, the first note is the amount of U.S. weapons delivered to Saudi Arabia in 2001, about $33 million worth. The whole decade is low notes like that. Then around 2009, the weapons, like you hear it, they go up. And then we get to 2011, that's the Arab Spring, and we start to hear more weapons arriving. Now, wait for this.
What is this?
The Yemen War.
Oh. Wow. So what happened there in the end, like that last high note?
Well, those high notes were the weapons delivered in 2017 and 2018. They were about 100 times more than in 2001.
Wow, really good way to understand this. So the Saudis are buying up a lot of weapons. What about their neighbors across the Middle East?
We can look at military budgets that countries publish. In 2017, for example, Saudi Arabia's military budget was the third largest in the entire world, right after the United States and China.
Wow, number three. That's incredible.
And for context, SIPRI data shows that Saudis spent more on their military that year than Russia did.
All right, these data points are interesting, but what do they actually mean aside from lots of weapons?
Well, with so many weapons out there, things could really get out of hand. Peter Vaseman says the big concern with Saudi Arabia is not that it's buying up a lot of weapons, but that it's using them.
Right. Now you're talking here about the war in Yemen.
And Vaseman worries that the Yemen war could actually spread. Last year, for example, the Yemeni rebels fired a missile right into Riyadh, the Saudi capital. The missile killed a man. Vaseman worries about what could follow.
What would have happened if one of those ballistic missiles would have killed many hundreds, or if it would have killed a high-level royal family member? Would then Saudi Arabia believe that now we have those advanced arms and Iran does not have them, now we can actually take military action against Iran to punish them? And if that happens, how will that escalate?
Yeah, that's a grim question, but what would that escalation look like, do you think?
It could be Saudi Arabia having a direct confrontation with Iran. It could draw the U.S. into a supporting role in a bigger war. So for context, let's look at the neighborhood. We know military spending totals of most of the Middle Eastern countries in 2017.
And what was that?
That sound represents a military expenditure of $1 billion.
What does $1 billion buy?
$1 billion will buy you 10 F-15 fighter jets. Or $1 billion could buy you 50,000 smart bombs. This is the 2017 military budget of Kuwait.
Wow.
Yes, that's Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah, I was going to say, is that machine gun?
It is. Seven measures of machine gun, or about $7 billion. Iraq spent just about the same.
Okay, what does Iran sound like?
In 2017, Iran spent $14.5 billion on its military. Israel spent $2 billion more than that.
And compare those two countries to Saudi Arabia.
This is Saudi Arabia's military spending from 2017.
How long is this going to go on for?
About 30 seconds.
Wow.
It's 70 measures long. The Saudis spent $70 billion in 2017.
Well, Stephen Snyder, counting weapons in the Middle East, sonically. Before you go, Stephen, if we use that Jimi Hendrix sound to represent the U.S. military budget, then how long would it play?
In 2017, the U.S. spent $700 billion. It would go on for about 5 minutes.
Well, I love Jimi Hendrix, but even that's a little too long. The World, Stephen Snyder, thank you. This was really good. Helped me really understand it.
Thanks, Marco.
If you've heard anything about Rakhine State in western Myanmar, it's probably that it's the home of the ethnic Rohingya, or it used to be. Myanmar's military has waged a brutal campaign to purge Rohingya Muslims from their homeland. The UN has called it ethnic cleansing. There's also a rebel uprising in the same area. So why are Myanmar officials now telling the world that Rakhine is an investor's dream? The World's Patrick Nguyen takes a look.
Do you have millions of dollars? Are you looking to invest somewhere unique? Well, the political leader of Myanmar, Aung San Suu Kyi, she says, look no further than Rakhine State.
Brimming with opportunities and warm and friendly people, all eager to be part of the development adventure.
It's an area about the size of Switzerland, only it's by the sea, pretty humid with lots of jungle, and the power is always going out. But Aung San Suu Kyi says, don't worry. it's still a good place to build resorts or factories. She said this in a speech to investors from China and South Korea and Japan all over. And she focused on Rakhine's pristine beaches and its ancient temples, built more than 5 centuries ago by the locals, Buddhists who call themselves the Arakan people.
This little-known religious complex of astounding beauty is a gem that has yet to be revealed to the world.
Yet, anyone who Googles Rakhine will see she's glossing over huge problems, problems she alludes to only briefly by blaming outsiders.
The international community's attention has been focused narrowly on negative aspects related to problems in North Rakhine.
North Rakhine, that is the home of the Rohingya, one of the most persecuted groups in the world. And negative aspects refers to soldiers brutally driving them from their villages into Bangladesh, the country next door. Back to the speech.
Rather than on the panoramic picture that shows the immense potential of this state for peace and prosperity.
This is a recent firefight, the government versus an insurgent group called the Arakan Army. This violence, that's on top of the Rohingya crisis. Remember those temples Suu Kyi mentioned, the gem of Rakhine? The rebels say it was our ancestors who built them, and now we're going to revive our greatness by kicking out the, quote, fascist government and their business cronies. Here's their 40-year-old commander, Tuan Ratnang, in a rebel propaganda video.
The land of Arakan is ours, our ancestral land, and we must get this back into the hand of our people.
They're actually pretty good at social media. These rebels have been bombing bridges, killing police, taking hostages. They've got about 7,000 fighters, men and women.
We are coming to take our country back.
If you want to know where that anger comes from, consider that in Rakhine, the average person makes just $500 a year. That's worse than North Korea. And yet, right off the coast, corporations from China and South Korea, plus Chevron, they are working with Aung San Suu Kyi's government to pump out billions of dollars worth of natural gas.
The local people regard offshore gas as a curse rather than the blessing.
Vicky Bowman is a former British ambassador to Myanmar. Now she runs an organization called the Center for Responsible Business, based in Yangon, the country's largest city.
The revenues from natural gas are going direct to the capital, and although some is trickling back, it's not sufficiently visible to the Rakhine peoples.
It's the kind of story you've heard before. Loads of wealth pulled out of the ground, and yet in the villages, the rebel commander says, you will see serious poverty.
Hungry children begging for the food, knocking your door, wet in the rain.
Now, it's even worse for the Rohingya. UN officials have used the word genocide to describe what has happened to them. So what kind of foreign investor would wade into this complex mess?
The people who are looking at investing in Rakhine are doing it because there are particular assets in Rakhine, whether it's those tourism beaches, whether it's the offshore gas, which are location-specific. If they want to be investing in gas in Myanmar, that's the place to be.
China is building a big port there and gas pipelines as part of their Belt and Road infrastructure spree. Now, I should mention, the beach resort area is like 200 miles away from the rebel zone. It is safe. But those amazing temples that Aung San Suu Kyi is promoting to tourists, well, if you go there right now, right by the ruins, people are taking refuge from army strikes against the rebels. By the way, this is from a video posted by a local youth group. Bowman, the former ambassador, she says it would really be a shame if Rakhine is just written off as a total no-go zone. The government isn't wrong, she says. People there do need jobs, badly, and foreign investment can help if it's not exploiting people. But if you do go near rebel turf to build a hotel or a factory, don't be shocked if guys with guns show up demanding a piece of the action.
So an investor going in there that was not willing to pay such demands is going to have a hard time. And that's why, generally, those investors will stay out.
For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
A comedian is a leading contender for president of Ukraine. Just one unusual detail about elections coming up there this weekend. The BBC's Jonah Fisher is following this election. He's in eastern Ukraine. Let's start with the comedian candidate, Vladimir Zelensky. You've met him. What's his deal? Why is he running for president?
Yeah, it's a pretty extraordinary story. Vladimir Zelensky has got no political experience whatsoever. And the extraordinary thing about him is that he's become famous here in Ukraine through a television program. And in that television program, he plays the president. And on the TV show, he's a principled, honest president doing the right thing. And his message on the campaign trail has basically been, if you vote for me, if I become president, you're pretty much going to get what you see in that TV series. And for now, and the way it's looking, according to the opinion polls, it looks like that message is working and we could be set to see the comedian become president.
What do Ukrainians like about his TV show that suggests they're going to like him as president?
Well, I think firstly, Ukrainians are ready for a change. They want something different. The other contenders in this race are, how we put it, from the old school of Ukrainian politics. The image that has been very much projected by Mr. Zelensky and his campaign team is that he's fresh-faced, he's different. He hasn't really been very specific about any policies. Indeed, many people say he doesn't really have a very solid grasp on policy matters at all.
So Zelensky is the splashy outsider in the lead, but there's also President Petro Poroshenko running for re-election and former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko in the race too. What are they campaigning on?
Well, we've got a massive ballot paper, actually. There are 39 candidates. But yeah, you've mentioned the top three there. So Petro Poroshenko, he's the current president of Ukraine. He's basically campaigning on the platform that you need an experienced guy like myself to face off with Russia, because Ukraine is effectively fighting a war with Russia in eastern Ukraine. So why take a chance on any of these other people? Yulia Tymoshenko, well, if you've been following Ukrainian politics at all over the last 10 years, you might remember her. She's a woman with a very distinctive blonde hair, braided hair. She's been a leader of protests in the past. So she is trying again, but she's failed twice as a presidential candidate. And I think people see her very much as being the outsider out of the top three.
Jonas, step back for a moment and tell us how you see it on the ground in eastern Ukraine. You're close to the front line. I mean, are you feeling it where you are?
We're not feeling it where we are. I mean, the overwhelming feeling in eastern Ukraine when you come here is that it's all a bit sad, really, that the young people have left, that you're left with old people who can't really go anywhere else. The conflict itself is not particularly hot. You can hear gunfire if you go right up to the front lines. Both sides do shell each other, but nobody is trying to win this war, to take territory, to make any sort of decisive impact. It just rumbles on. Two or three people tend to die every week here. It's not a war that gets a lot of international attention, but it is very much an unresolved war. And the whole process around trying to negotiate some sort of solution to what's happening on here has really gone nowhere over the last few years. So it's particularly bleak for the people who live here, because, you know, many of them have got friends on the other side in rebel-controlled territories who it's very hard for them to see and deal with, family on the other side, very hard for them to cross and go and see them too. So, you know, it's got a sadness to it here, because, you know, there appears, whatever happens in this election, it really appears that there's very little prospect of this conflict coming to an end anytime soon.
The BBC's Jonah Fisher speaking with us from eastern Ukraine. Thanks very much for your time, Jonah.
Thanks, Marco.
When I'm traveling, I'll check online reviews for things like hotels and Airbnbs. Makes sense. They give you a basic idea of what to expect, like the rooms weren't clean, the neighborhood is noisy or quiet. But what if it's a question about safety? The World's Allison Herrera has a story of one woman who tried to give a warning on TripAdvisor.
Kate was celebrating in a restaurant after a kayaking expedition in East Africa last fall. She was having drinks and dinner with the local tour guide and others on the trip. Afterwards, she says she went back to the hotel with a fellow traveler who was sharing her room. Hours later, Kate says the tour guide somehow entered their room and sexually assaulted her.
We were both asleep, and I just woke up to him on top of me.
Kate is a pseudonym we're using to protect her identity. She also asked us not to identify where the assault took place. She says she ran out into the hall, screaming. Other guests came out, and the tour guide was taken to the police station. She says he was questioned and then let go. Kate is still pursuing legal action, but there's another thing she wants to do: warn other travelers about this tour guide. So she found his tour business on TripAdvisor, the popular online travel platform, and tried to post a review.
It wasn't written in first person. It was written in, like, warning, you know, tour guide, rape tourists, wanted by the police, you know, stay away, like along those lines.
But her review was never posted on the site. So she asked friends to post reviews, including people who had been on the trip with her. And their comments weren't posted either. When Kate finally managed to get in touch with TripAdvisor, they told her,
I'm sorry, we cannot post your review because it is not written in first person. Here are our community guidelines, blah, 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 only first-hand.
That's TripAdvisor's policy, says Desiree Fish, vice president for global communications. No third-person accounts for legal reasons.
You know, one of the things that we do is we have the platform where people can write a first-person account. No, at no time were we asking a victim or a survivor to provide details and graphic details of their assault.
But Kate says writing about her attack in the first person for a review would be re-traumatizing. And while TripAdvisor sent her other first-person accounts of sexual assault on its site, Kate says those reviews aren't prominent enough, and the people who wrote them have been trolled.
As a survivor, I don't want to write a first-hand review of my rape on your site. Mm-hmm. I want to be able to report to you, you know, to a human being, to someone, and I want you to have a very visible and effective, I don't know, labeling system.
Fish says they're not trying to hide posts about rape or assault.
They can look at all the negative reviews on any business listing, but we're looking for other ways to surface those negative reviews. But we need a review to be able to do that.
Kate is asking TripAdvisor to include a hotline number where you can speak directly to a human with a safety concern. As to whether TripAdvisor would remove the tour guide listing from their site, Fish says that's not helpful.
Because people would still find that business in other places and not be able to then go to TripAdvisor and read, did somebody have an experience? Can I search through? I'm curious if there was a negative experience here.
Desiree Fish says TripAdvisor is a place where, if something bad happens, travelers can speak up. The question is whether you'll be able to see that bad review. For The World, I'm Allison Herrera.
On a related note, let me bring The World's Lucy Martirosian into the studio. Hey, Lucy.
Hey, Marco.
So you've got something to share with our listeners about solo women travelers, right?
Yeah, because there's been a lot in the news lately about women traveling alone. So we want to hear from women and non-binary people. Why do you travel alone? How does it make you feel? What kind of reactions do you get from friends and family? And what safety precautions do you take, if any?
It is a trending topic, so record a voice memo and send it to us at myworld@theworld.org. Your story might end up on the show. Be sure to leave your name, age, where you live, and of course, how you listen to The World every day, your local station or online.
Again, send your comments to myworld@theworld.org.
Great. Thanks very much, Lucy. Okay, a bit of Brexit news for you now. British Prime Minister Theresa May says she will quit once Brexit is delivered. I repeat, once Brexit is delivered. It could be a while. For one thing, May's deal to leave the European Union is in limbo. Parliament already voted against it twice, and the Speaker of the House of Commons is refusing to schedule another vote on it. Today, things got worse for Theresa May. Members of Parliament from across the political spectrum have been debating their own alternatives to her Brexit plan. They don't actually have the government's permission to do this. Instead, they've overridden May's government to give themselves permission. Conservative Nick Bowles today appealed to all MPs to forget their party affiliation.
In that historic week when Parliament took charge of the nation's destiny, what did you do? Did you stand up and lead? Did you step forward to help reunite our country? Or did you hang back in your party trench, waiting to be told what to do and where to go?
So now the hope for British politicians is that they can find consensus on a single plan for Brexit and then vote on it next week. Chi Awunra is a Labour Party MP from Newcastle. She wants to rebuild unity after the disunity caused by the 2016 Brexit referendum.
It divided our city, and I was determined we should not have to vote again. But this is a complete shambles. Parliament gridlocked, government paralysed, businesses stalled, jobs lost, households stockpiling, our global reputation trashed.
So with more votes scheduled, this will be another late night for Parliament in London. We'll have a full update for you tomorrow here on The World. Still on the other side of the pond for this final note today, a farewell, really, to Ranking Roger, vocalist for The Beat, or The English Beat, as we Yanks call them. Ranking Roger died yesterday at his home in the UK. He'd been fighting cancer, was only 56. Ranking Roger and The Beat hailed from working-class Birmingham in the English Midlands. Real name, Roger Charlery, the son of immigrants from St. Lucia in the Caribbean. Started out a punk rocker and eventually helped develop The Beat's signature fusion of punk, reggae, pop, and soul, the new British ska. The Beat came together in the late 1970s. They were huge in the early 80s there and here in the States. Big part of my musical diet over the years for sure. The band posted a tribute to Ranking Roger on its website today. He fought and fought and fought, it reads. Roger was a fighter. We'll keep on fighting for you, Roger. That is our show today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you again tomorrow.
RI, Public Radio International.